Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Jim Brewster with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open our show with our Capitol Report, with an analysis on just what the final version of the federal tax bill now awaiting President Trump's signature does and doesn't include, as well as its potential impacts on health care, the economy, and the national debt. Locally, there's good news from the County Health Department on drop-in hepatitis cases. Here in East County, some rural and mountain residents are raising objection to a new round of planned power outages announced by SDG&E over the holiday season, this time for repairs. Hear why residents want the utility to postpone those actions until after the new year. On our local government report, hear about body cameras on deputies in Lemon Grove and the city's newest key appointments. Plus, we'll tell you about a special holiday celebration for homeless children in El Cajon, a plane crash near Gillespie Field, a warning from state health officials about cell phone dangers, and a program offering free child car safety seats to low-income parents. Learn about scholarships available to local students through the San Diego Foundation, and where you can recycle your Christmas tree after the holidays. Our newsmaker interview today is with El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells. He'll be talking about one of the biggest East County news stories of the year, the city's partnership with Live Nation to reopen the East County Performing Arts Center. He'll also talk about economic revitalization in El Cajon, as well as offer his insights as a psychiatric worker at a local emergency room on his new idea to provide long-term help and housing for the homeless. And finally, on Destination East County, we'll tell you about some fun and festive events coming up in our inland region, from New Year's celebrations to a falconry demonstration in Santa Isabel, full moon fishing at Lake Jennings, a stage production based on the mystery writer Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap, and a production in January of Carnival Fantastique. So stay tuned for all of these stories on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. And to all of you, from all of us at East County Magazine, we wish you a joyous holiday season and a happy, healthy new year.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Jim Brewster with a Capitol Report. The House and Senate have approved a final version of a sweeping tax reform bill that is now on President Donald Trump's desk awaiting signature. The measure provides huge permanent tax cuts for corporations and wealthy individuals, also providing temporary tax relief for many other individuals that will take effect in 2019 and expire in 8 years. Many of those cuts will be offset, however, by loss of popular tax deductions and a provision that is expected to raise rates for Affordable Care Act health care policies. Among San Diego's representatives, only Republican Duncan Hunter voted in favor. Republican Darrell Issa joined with Democrat Susan Davis, Scott Peters, and Juan Vargas to vote against the bill, as did California's two senators, Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein. Here's a summary of what's in the final bill, including key last-minute changes. The corporate tax rate drops from 35 to 21%. The tax rate on the wealthy, those earning over $500,000 a year or $600,000 for couples, drops from 39.6 to 37%. About 75% of taxpayers are expected to see some decrease in taxes, at least temporarily. The New York Times has a tax cut calculator. The bill raises the deficit by $1.3 trillion, and no plan for reducing that deficit was included. Republicans say the bill will stimulate the economy and create jobs, but Democrats fear Republicans may seek to gut Social Security and Medicare payments to pay for the tax cuts. Slashing revenues deeply also raises concerns over how to fund key programs in the future, from infrastructure repairs to the military. The bill doubles the standard deduction to $12,000 for individuals and $24,000 for married families. More people will be filing under the standard deduction, but doing so means you can deduct items such as charitable contributions and mortgage interest. You can no longer deduct state and local taxes over $10,000. Deductions for mortgage loans are now capped at $750,000, so you can't write off mortgage costs above that level. The child tax credit rises from $1,000 to $2,000 and more if it is deductible. Estate taxes are eliminated on estates up to $22 million. The mandate to buy health insurance will disappear in 2019, an action the Congressional Budget Office estimates will result in 13 million people losing health care under the Affordable Health Care Act, since this will lead to raising premiums if younger, healthier people opt out, as expected, requiring insurers to cover older, sicker patients at higher cost. Pass-through companies get a 20% tax cut, including S-corporations, LLCs, partnerships, and sole proprietorships. The alternative minimum tax is eliminated for corporations, and the threshold for alternative minimum taxes for individuals is raised to $500,000 for individuals and $1 million for married couples. Last-minute changes to the bill by the Senate restored some deductions that the House had previously cut, so student loan deductions, the medical expense deduction, and the graduate student tuition waivers remain. A provision that would have allowed churches to endorse political candidates was also removed in the final version of the bill.
This is John Pastier with a health report. This holiday week, County Health and Human Services has some cheery news. The region's hepatitis A outbreak appears to have peaked, and there is a significant drop in the number of new cases reported. Between May and September, there was an average of just over 84 confirmed cases per month. That number slowed to 34 cases in October and dropped to 20 in November. So far, there have been just 2 confirmed or probable cases reported in December. Since the outbreak was identified in March 2017, there have been 571 confirmed cases, resulting in 390 hospitalizations and 20 deaths. The county and community partners have given 113,230 vaccinations, most of those to people in at-risk populations, including the homeless, IV drug users, gay men, health workers, and those who work closely with people in high-risk groups. The county is also providing education and food safety guidelines to the faith-based community so they can continue their charity and food distribution efforts over the holidays in the unincorporated areas of the county. Though the city of El Cajon has prohibited public feedings of the homeless until the county ends the emergency declaration, the County Board of Supervisors on Tuesday extended the local health emergency for hepatitis A another 2 weeks.
This is Jonathan Getz with a local government report from Lemon Grove. All sheriff deputies assigned permanently to Lemon Grove Station now have body cameras, Lieutenant Amos informed the Lemon Grove City Council at a meeting on December 19th. Mayor Raquel Vasquez asked if the public would have access to the videos, to which Amos discussed a process by which videos may be released. Councilman David Arambula wanted to know if calls to dispatch are being archived live, to which Amos responded that calls would be updated at the end of the day when officers return to the station and plug in their body cameras to be charged and uploaded. The sheriff's department declined a body-worn camera that charges in the car because it could be too cumbersome to take on and off or be tethered during shifts. The public was warned that if an officer feels his or her life is threatened, the officer may not reach first for the camera, so there may still be times when footage is not available. Once activated, the body camera saves 30 seconds before it is turned on, in addition to going live. Studies have shown that citizen complaints are often cut in half after body cameras are added, since both deputies and citizens behave better, testified the sheriff's department. The council also approved Councilman Jerry Jones as the new mayor pro tem. Mayor Vasquez will replace Jones as Lemon Grove's representative on San Diego Association of Governments, or SANDAG. Council also heard updates on community efforts to raise funds for Lemon Grove Little League. Fields are brown after water was turned off in the off-season due to a funding shortage and an irrigation leak that caused a $27,000 slope failure. Mendoza announced that the Lions Club had raised between $2,000 and $3,000 for the Lemon Grove Little League. The council approved a memorandum of understanding with the Little League. Council seemed reluctant to fund over $26,000 in turf maintenance, but offered to call on city cleanup volunteers to help get fields in shape for the new season, and suggested naming rights for fields in exchange for annual maintenance fees. According to City Manager Lydia Romero, Lemon Grove can commit to pay $1,440 for an irrigation audit immediately, and staff can come back with a plan to pay the Little League's $3,300 outstanding water bill at the January 16th meeting.
SDG&E has restored power to residents affected by planned electrical outages due to high winds and the utility's goal of preventing its lines from sparking fires. Some outages lasted a week or more, and residents have complained that despite SDG&E sending out press releases encouraging residents to file claims for spoiled food or other damages, the utility has denied some early claims. Now SDG&E has announced a new round of planned outages, this time for equipment repairs. The utility's site indicates that notices were sent to impacted customers in nearly 36 communities this week. The company's map stated that some outages could last 10 hours or more. Now some rural and mountain residents are asking why the repairs can't wait, since shutting off power during the holiday season raises several new concerns. Burglar alarms don't work, leaving homes vulnerable, particularly if residents are traveling away for the holiday season. Temperatures are frigid, with snow possible in some impacted areas. Many residents who lost food during prolonged outages have just replaced it, including food items for holiday meals that now could be lost again. Outage delays before Christmas could also ruin holiday parties, family gatherings, holiday shopping for merchants, and religious activities. We have contacted SDG&E to ask why these repairs are scheduled now and whether they can wait until after the holiday season, and we'll report back once we receive a response. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Meridian Broaddus with the People Power Report. Over 150 homeless children at the East County Transitional Living Center in El Cajon received gifts of clothing, athletic shoes, and a good dose of Christmas joy at the 5th annual Christmas party last Saturday in the center's community hall. Gifts were provided by the Church of the Nativity Catholic Parish, located in Rancho Santa Fe, as a part of their Giving Tree, where parishioners purchase a personal gift for each child. San Miguel Fire District firefighters were on hand to give each homeless child a gift and a warm smile, as well as playing a guitar and singing Christmas songs. The program also included storytelling and refreshments. Over 150 children are living at East County Transitional Living Center as their parents are transforming from homelessness into becoming self-sufficient citizens.
This is Krajai Broaddus with an education report. If you're seeking a college education, here's some good news for you. The San Diego Foundation wants students to know that hundreds of scholarships are available for San Diego students to pursue their dreams of higher education. Using one online application, students can access more than 100 types of scholarships for the 2018-2019 academic year, with awards generally ranging from $1,000 to $5,000. Awards are granted to four-year universities, two-year colleges, graduate or trade vocational schools. The Common Scholarship application is available online now until February 1st, 2018 at 2 o'clock p.m. The San Diego Foundation Community Scholarship Program is the largest in the region outside the university system. It provides a variety of scholarships to high school students, current college students, graduate students, and adult re-entry students. Since 1997, the program has awarded more than $28.7 million to thousands of students. The Common Scholarship application can be accessed at sdfoundation.org/scholarship application. For more information about the scholarship process, you can contact scholarships@sdfoundation.org.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. With another holiday season upon us, I Love a Clean San Diego and the County of San Diego have again joined together to encourage residents to recycle their Christmas trees and minimize the amount of waste sent to the landfill. You can put your tree to better use through recycling at locations countywide. When organic materials such as Christmas trees, food, and yard clippings are sent to the landfill, they release methane, a greenhouse gas that's 25 times as potent as carbon dioxide in warming up the atmosphere. Recycling these materials prevents needless organic material from occupying space in our crowded San Diego landfills and reduces greenhouse gas generation. Recycled Christmas trees are then made into mulch, which is then used to improve soil health at public parks, local farms, and homes. Thanks to the partnership between I Love a Clean San Diego and the county, recycling your holiday tree doesn't have to be a headache. Many local waste haulers offer curbside pickup of Christmas trees and wreaths. In addition to curbside pickup, Christmas tree drop-off sites are located in East County, South County, and North County. Here in East County, those locations include El Cajon, La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and Ramona. Before recycling your Christmas tree, review these recycling tips to assure that your tree is recycled properly. Trees taller than 4 feet should be cut in half or in pieces less than 4 feet long. Remove ornaments, garland, tinsel, lights, nails, and tree stands if the stands are made of metal or plastic. Check with your local hauler to see if they accept flocked trees with fake snow. For a list of recycling sites, as well as companies that offer pickup of Christmas trees, you can visit wastefreesd.org.
This is John Fisteer with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego's Health and Human Services Agency. Low-income parents can receive free child safety seats thanks to an $88,000 grant from the federal government. The county will offer child passenger safety education classes over the next 9 months and will also give away 133 child safety seats to people in need. Keeping children safe while they ride with their parents or friends is part of the county's Live Well San Diego vision, which aims to improve the health and safety of children and families in the region. The child safety workshops and free child car seats will be provided through September 2018 and are part of the Keep 'em Safe program. This is the 8th year the county has received funding from OTS. Motor vehicle injuries remain a public health challenge, especially among low-income families and underrepresented communities, and accessibility to education is critical, according to the county. For more information about the Keep 'em Safe program, you can contact the Pacific Safety Center toll-free at 855-4-PSC-411. That number again is 855-4-PSC-411.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Meridian Broadus with a health report. As smartphone use continues to increase in the U.S., especially among young children, the California Department of Public Health has issued guidance for individuals and families who want to decrease their exposure to the radio frequency emitted from cell phones. Cell phones emit radio frequency energy when they send and receive signals to and from cell towers, and some scientists and public health officials believe this energy may impact human health. Some research suggests long-term high use may impact human health, the agency warns. Some research suggests long-term high use may impact human health, the agency warns. Dr. Karen Smith, director of the state's public health department, warns, although the science is still evolving, there are concerns among some public health professionals and members of the public regarding long-term high use exposure to the energy emitted by cell phones. She adds, we know that simple steps such as not keeping your phone in your pocket and moving it away from your bed at night can help reduce exposure for both children and adults. Meanwhile, cell phone use in the U.S. has increased dramatically in recent years. About 95% of Americans own a cell phone, and 12% rely on their smartphones for everyday internet access. In addition, the average age when children get their first cell phone is now just 10 years old, and a majority of young people keep their phones on or near them most of the day and while they sleep. Children's brains develop through the teenage years and may be more affected by cell phone use, said Dr. Smith. Parents should consider reducing the time their children use cell phones and encourage them to turn the devices off at night. The new state guidelines include practical steps both adults and children can take to reduce exposure to radio frequency energy from cell phones. Those steps include keeping the phone away from the body, reducing cell phone use when the signal is weak, reducing use of cell phones to stream audio or video, download or unplug large files, keeping the phone away from the bed at night, removing headsets when not on a call, and avoiding products that claim to block radio frequency energy, since these products may actually increase your exposure, according to California's Public Health Department.
A small plane crashed in El Cajon on Saturday, December 19th, shortly after taking off from Gillespie Field. The pilot had reported engine trouble and was attempting to return to the airport when the plane crash landed near Gillespie Way and Weld, then burst into flames. Fortunately, the pilot and both passengers were able to escape the wreckage before the fire. The pilot and co-pilot, both police officers from Huntington Beach, were treated at a local hospital and released. A third man remains hospitalized as of our show taping deadline. The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, is investigating the cause of the crash. But given the fireball that occurred, witnesses agree that the plane's three occupants are fortunate to have survived what could have been a holiday season tragedy. Reporting from East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Kajai Broadus.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Valerie Watts
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes New Year's celebrations in Alpine and Jamul, falconry demonstrations at Wainola Pizza, a star party at Mission Trails, Sinatra and Friends in Borrego Springs, Carnival Fantastique at Sequan, full moon fishing at Lake Jennings, and Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap at Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
East County's biggest New Year's festivities happen at the Viejas Resort and Casino. On New Year's Eve, December 31st, you're invited to ring in the new year at one of two celebrations. An outdoor bash in the park from 8 p.m. to 1:30 a.m. features a ball drop and fireworks at midnight, live entertainment by Rising Star, multiple bars and food offerings for purchase. Or opt for an elegant, upscale evening in the Oak Ballroom starting at 8 p.m. with live music, dancing, gourmet dining until 10 p.m., drinks, and the signature ball drop at midnight. For tickets and details on these New Year's celebrations, visit viejas.com and click on the Entertainment tab.
Hollywood Casino in Jamul is hosting several New Year's Eve parties at its restaurants and lounges. You can party like a rock star at the Loft 94 Beer Garden or in the Jive Lounge, where live entertainment by Funk's Most Wanted and Pop Vinyl will be provided. Or you can opt for an upscale New Year's Eve dinner at the Final Cut Steakhouse. For reservations and details, you can visit HollywoodCasinoJamul.com/NYE2018, as in New Year's Eve 2018.
Master Falconer Cisco Clyborn will present a falconry demonstration at Wainola Pizza each Saturday in January from 11:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Wainola Pizza is located on California 78 in Santa Isabel, just before you reach Julian. Guests will see interactive flights and educational demonstration with hawks and falcons. You can watch Poncho the Peregrine Falcon swoop from the sky to allure observe other falcons fly to a drone used to train them to reach elevated heights, and experience interactive flights with two Harris Hawks who fly to the fist of a falconry glove. You can also take up close and personal photos with the raptors.
Mission Trails Regional Park invites you to a star party on Saturday, January 6th from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. The park's trail guide and amateur astronomer George Varga will be at the far end of the Kumeyaay Lake Campground's day-use parking lot with a telescope available for viewing the nighttime sky. Viewing at this event will include the Pleiades, or Seven Sisters constellation, the Double Cluster in Perseus, the Andromeda Galaxy, and more. This event will be canceled if it's raining or cloudy. For more information, you can visit Mission Trails Regional Park's website at mtrp.org.
Sinatra and Friends paid tribute to the man and his music, featuring countless songs synonymous with Frank Sinatra, as well as many other memorable favorites people have come to love. The performance will be staged at the Borrego Springs Performing Arts Center on Saturday, January 6th, with performances at 7:30 and 9 p.m. For tickets, visit BSPAC, for Borrego Springs Performing Arts Center, bspac.us.
Carnaval Fantastique will bring performers from around the world to Sequan's Theater on January 7th in a celebration of music and action that combines gravity-defying acrobatics, contortionists, jugglers, comedy, beautiful dancers, and dynamic laser special effects. The finale highlights a one-of-a-kind laser salute to America patriotic performance. You're invited to Come One, Come All, It's Carnaval. For tickets, you can visit sequan.com.
You're invited to fish by the light of a full moon on Saturday, January 13th at Lake Jennings in Lakeside. The lake is stocked with trout, bass, bluegill, and sunfish. For more information, you can visit lakejennings.org.
Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa will present Agatha Christie's classic mystery, The Mousetrap, from January 13th through February 4th. A terrible snowstorm traps a group of strangers in a quaint boarding house. To everyone's horror, it soon becomes clear that a murderer is hiding among them. A policeman arrives to investigate, and as the characters testify and reenact the events of the night, the trap is set to catch the killer. This thrilling whodunit by Agatha Christie, author of so many classic English murder mysteries, is known for its unpredictable ending. Can you pinpoint the murderer before the characters do? The original production of The Mousetrap on London's West End has now been running continuously for 61 years, during which period it's been performed more than 25,000 times, making it the most popular whodunit of all time and the longest-running show of any type in the modern era. For tickets and details, you can visit lamplighterslamesa.com.
That's all for this week.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County Show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County!
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, my very special guest is the mayor of El Cajon, Bill Wells. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, you have a lot of big news, but let's start, for listeners that may not have heard yet, with probably the biggest news to come out of East County in a few years, the reopening of the Performing Arts Center. Can you give us some details, please?
Yeah. I'm not sure if everybody knows this, but several years ago we had to close the Performing Arts Center, mostly because it was financially unviable. And this was especially in 2008.
Right, and it needed a lot of repairs. It needed ADA upgrades. It needed a new roof. And in the depths of the recession, that was pretty tough for a struggling city to do.
That's exactly right. And so we made a difficult decision at that point, and we closed the Performing Arts Center, really always with the understanding that we would eventually reopen it. But one of the things that I was committed to was not reopening it until we had a really good plan.
Right. I mean, we should say at one point there was a proposal to tear it down, turn it into a hotel, but the council voted against that. And there were various other ideas that came forward through the years, but none of them seemed like they offered long-term viability.
No. And we knew that if we were going to reopen it, we had to do it differently, that we didn't feel like the Performing Arts Center could survive another false start.
Right.
And so one of our criteria was that we really felt that we had to have a professional management company come in. And so for quite a while, we were looking for the right professional management company. Of course, we always thought at that point that pie-in-the-sky dream would be to have Live Nation take over. But
the largest concert management company in the world, I understand. That's according to Doug Williford, your city manager.
That is absolutely true. And frankly, that was pretty pie-in-the-sky to think that they would be interested in coming in and managing a small theater like this. Mm-hmm. But I have to give all the credit to Doug. He really had this vision in mind, and he went after them, and it took a couple of years, but he finally got them to agree to come down and look at it. And once they came down and looked at it, they said, wow, we're really interested. It's a beautiful theater.
Well, you know, when it was built, at the time, they said that it had the finest acoustics of any theater in San Diego County. That was before the Fox Theater for the Symphony Hall was built, but still, it was better than anything else out there, and presumably still is.
I believe so. And certainly Live Nation felt that it was a great theater that they could really put on some great shows, and they could make it financially feasible for them.
Yeah.
And so we entered into contract negotiations, which took about a year. And it's fairly complicated because not only is it their management fee, but they had some requirements about new sound, soundboards and lighting and physical changes to the theater itself, all of which are going to cost money. And we had to raise that money. So the whole process took longer than we expected, but last week we finally signed a final contract, and we're going to start construction soon, and Live Nation will be taking over the theater, and they promised to bring us 70 shows a year, if not more.
And when is the estimated date that it will actually reopen to the public?
It's going to take about a year.
Great. So around early 2019?
Yeah, I would really like to see it happen in 2018, but that's probably more realistic to believe early 2019, first quarter.
Yeah, fantastic. So we're liable to see a return to some of the headliner stars, and what else?
Live Nation's focus will be bringing in a certain kind of act.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it won't be the same kind of act that's selling out stadiums, but it might be, like there's a group called Pink Martini, which has kind of a small cult following, or maybe people that like Boz Scaggs. He'd come to town and fill 1,000 seats.
Yeah, and they've done very well. We should note that some of the other theaters that they took over the management of, there were places where it was costing cities, I understand, you know, maybe millions of dollars in subsidies, and that actually dropped substantially. So from a fiscal standpoint, while it's impossible to run a theater with no subsidy, I understand that it can really bring it way down and actually make it much more affordable for a city to offer arts and culture to the community.
It's going to be expensive. There's no way around that. Mm-hmm. You know, having a theater in your town is kind of like sending your kids to private school. Mm-hmm. There's always a cheaper way to do it. You send your kids to public school, and some people think that it's a extravagance and a waste to do something like that. But it's a quality of life issue. And we have this beautiful theater here. I see no reason to waste that. I mean, that's that to rebuild a theater like that, I don't know, would cost well over $15-20 million.
Oh yeah.
So
it's such a wonderful resource. Now, you're passionate about the arts yourself. I understand that you play several musical instruments. You were tickling the ivories here on my piano when you came in, but what else do you play, Bill?
I play piano and guitar and saxophone.
Wow.
And music really, in a lot of ways, really saved my life. I was
really.
I grew up in the inner city, and it was just my mom and me, and didn't have a lot of direction, and was kind of lost and wandering. And then We moved to Rancho Bernardo area, and the first person I met told me that I should join the band in junior high. I was in eighth grade, last year of junior high. Mm-hmm. So I went, and the band director asked me if I played, and I lied, and I said, yes, I played an instrument. And he said, what do you play? And my friend said, tell him saxophone. I said, okay, saxophone.
Oh, my.
So he gave me a saxophone. He let me sit in the band for about 6 weeks, and he finally pulled me aside and said, look, I don't care that you can't play, but you're going to have to learn. And so he gave me a fingering chart.
Good teacher.
And I started really taking it seriously and learning to play. And I was really good at it. It was the first thing I was really good at in my life.
Yeah, music can really be such an inspiring thing for so many children. I used to work at Thorough Music, you know, was my working my way through college jobs. And you just see the kids' faces light up when they would come in. They would try out a clarinet or a trumpet or something like that, or a piano. And, of course, you know, the theater arts is another thing. I know Councilman Kendrick probably deserves some credit here, too. I remember way back when his son grew up in junior theater and is now, what, a screenwriter in Hollywood?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so Gary understood also the importance that the arts can make in kids' lives. Now, what's going to happen as far as community groups? I know in the past there were times where Christian Youth Theater ran the theater, where another arts group ran it. I know that at first it's very expensive, and they're saying some of the community groups may not be able to afford the rental fees. Is there a long-term plan to help them with that?
I think we have a solution to that. I mean, certainly has to be voted on by the entire council, but my proposal will be to set aside a fund for nonprofit groups that want to use the theater, say a dance recital.
Great.
So part of the contract is that if somebody uses the theater, we can't bring in just anybody to run it. It's got to be Live Nation employees.
Right.
So there's going to be some cost involved.
But there could be a fund where community groups can come in.
So I'm thinking about setting aside like $10,000 where, if somebody meets the criteria to come in, we can pay those fees for them.
Yeah.
They can have the use of the theater for nothing or for a very nominal fee.
Yeah.
And because that's part of a community theater, you've got to be able to have, you know, dance recitals and a kid's Christmas play
and
you know, things that have nothing to do with raising money.
Well, I'm thinking too about the Grossmont Community College Association. I think Ray Lutz testified that they actually had to close their doors with the theater shut for so many years, but that he's hoping maybe they'll be able to revive that and bring it back. And they used to actually sell out and fill up the theater. So,
well, I think there's a solution to all these issues. What I am committed to is making sure that we have set-aside days throughout the year for people in the community to use the theater.
That's wonderful to hear. Now, the theater, of course, is the biggest news this week, maybe this year in El Cajon, but it's not the only news. There's a lot more happening. As you talked about last week in your State of the City address, Bill, tell us a little bit more about what's happening in El Cajon.
Probably my most important job, which is not the most exciting part of the job, but probably the most important, is making sure that we continue to have enough revenue coming into the city so we can pay for police and fire and parks and streets and all the things that, you know, we have a $150 million budget.
Right. I mean, one can argue whether you're on left, right, or whatever about how the money should be allocated, but if you don't have enough of it, you really can't do what anybody wants.
And frankly, most of the money that we spend, I'd say 99% of the money that we spend, is not controversial at all.
No.
Left or right, everybody wants to have a street without potholes.
Right.
And
the police to show up when you call them.
Right. And if you have a heart attack, you want the fire department to be there and properly trained and have enough people. So all that's important for everybody.
Right.
I'm committed to not raising taxes. So it's important to me to keep enough revenue coming into the city. So one of the things I did several years ago was sit down and look at what we're good at. And one of the things that our city has been really good at is car sales. So we've really pushed car sales in the past 5-6 years. As a result, BMW was going to leave and go out of town. We worked out a tax sharing agreement with them for a small period of time so that they would go ahead and stay in the East County. They built a new facility.
You got a new Mercedes dealership now?
Mercedes built a new $25 million facility.
Wow.
Jaguar and Land Rover will be building this year.
Which is amazing because, you know, let's face it, it's East County, El Cajon, it actually has a fairly high poverty rate compared to some other areas, and yet you've done quite an accomplishment, I think, to get people from other areas to come to El Cajon to buy these luxury cars, and that fills up the coffers with, you know, all that sales tax revenue, which can be used for local projects.
It does. You know, if we can get the money from people outside of the local area to come in and spend their money here, then we can have access to that tax money without raising taxes on our citizens. And I think it's a win-win for us.
Yeah, and we will say that some of the things you do, it's, I think, quite good for the community. You guys do more street festivals and street fairs, and while we're seeing some other cities that have contracted the number of things they're doing, you guys are expanding that.
Well, that's by design. You know, we have spent so much time really building the city up and fixing a lot of the problems that one of the things that frustrates me is that unless you come to El Cajon for some reason, you live here, most people that I run into that are kind of North County-centric or beach-centric, a little bit, they don't come to El Cajon. There's no reason for them. So we have the Oktoberfest, the Hauntfest, the Half Marathon, the Mother Goose Parade, the America on Main Street.
Which is great and very multicultural. You have every culture out there, every kind of food.
And we do all that. You know, like, for example, Hauntfest brought in 40,000 people.
Wow.
As did the Mother Goose Parade. Most of those people come from outside of town. They haven't been to El Cajon. They come in for the parade or for the Hauntfest. Mm-hmm. They bring their kids. And they look around the downtown area and they say, wow, it's really not the El Cajon I knew in the 70s or 80s.
I will say, even when we started the magazine about 9 years ago, at the time, depths of the recession, many of the businesses were boarded up along Main Street. That was before you were mayor. You know, there was a XXX bookstore out there. It just wasn't, you know, the savory kind of place where you might feel safe walking the streets at night. Now there's restaurants and sidewalk cafes. Some of these are immigrant-owned businesses that have come in and, you know, opened things up. The city, with all the festivals, is certainly helping them to be all successful, all the businesses down there. And then now you've got the Performing Arts Center ready to open, which will also be a magnet to draw people from all over. And you have the a new hotel now. We talked about deciding not to tear down the theater and build a hotel, but I understand now you're getting a brand new hotel, getting ready to open in January.
Yeah, that's quite an accomplishment. The Marriott is building the first 5-star hotel in the entire East County. That's all the cities in the East County. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, we always knew that there was room in the market for that. But once we talked Marriott into coming in, right on the heels of that, the Hilton Corporation came in and said, we'd also like to build a hotel.
Really?
So they bought the old police station over by the mall.
Oh, wow.
And they're going to be building a Hilton brand hotel.
And then you use the sale of the police station revenues to help support getting the theater reopened. So that worked.
Yeah, that was a one-time ability to bring in some money. So that was a great thing that happened.
Wonderful. Now, it hasn't been 100% rosy. Probably the most controversial issue in El Cajon recently, as I should say it is regionally and even nationally, has been the homeless crisis, particularly not only high homelessness, but also the hepatitis outbreak. El Cajon, you know, they've had some maybe negative coverage for the ban on feeding the homeless in public parks short term because of the hepatitis concerns, where some are concerned about that. And I know it was to protect public health. But I think a lot of people don't realize that El Cajon actually has taken a lot of positive steps that most of the other cities in East County, maybe all of them, have really not done. Can you tell us about what you have approved to help the homeless?
Well, frankly, I believe that per capita, El Cajon has done more for the homeless than really any other city in the region.
Yeah.
We've taken this problem very seriously. I should say that it's a problem that's very close to me. Mm-hmm. I work as a psychologist, and I work in a psychiatric hospital where I work in the ER, and I see patients that come in probably somewhere around 60-70% of the patients I see are homeless.
Yeah, a lot of the homeless they're suffering from mental illness, which is a huge problem.
Mental illness is a big problem, and drug addiction is a huge problem. Yeah. And so I work with these people very closely, and I have a lot of compassion for them. So it's important to me that we do as much as we possibly can. So El Cajon, probably the biggest gem in our crown in this respect, is not a specifically government program. It's a government private partnership. And that's the East County Transitional Living Center. They're serving 500,000 meals a year now.
Wow.
Because they're so efficient, they serve it at 17 cents per meal.
Amazing.
They've brought over 600 families off the streets, and they keep people for up to 2 years.
They're really doing a very good job in many ways, especially helping a lot of the women and the children get off the streets and getting some of them into job training or drug rehab or whatever they need, alcohol rehab programs.
I think it's a wonderful model. It's controversial because it started off at least as a religious-based program. It's undeniable the work they've done, and
What would it take to have a similar program, but that was non-secular? So if somebody was, you know, Jewish or Muslim or Hindu or Buddhist or atheist, they would have a place they would feel comfortable going.
The East County Transitional Living Center does have a non-religious component to it, so they can serve that population.
Right, the short-term housing.
But more needs to be done, and right now I've been studying this concept called supportive housing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically the same concept. You build transitional living houses, but it's a little different. First off, you don't expect that these people will ever be discharging or leaving from your facility.
So it's kind of a housing first thing, get them into housing, but then get them supportive services they might need.
Here's the difference. Housing first kind of has a let's just build it and let anybody live there and have no restrictions upon people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the proper way to do it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the compassionate way to do it. Because by doing that, you're just saying to people, we're completely fine with you staying in your drug and alcohol addiction. Supportive housing requires people to see a psychiatrist about their psychiatric problems, mm-hmm. to take their meds.
Go straight if they have an alcohol problem. Drug problem.
At least to work towards getting off drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
To work with a therapist, to work with a program, to make that a goal to be off drugs and alcohol.
Seems sensible.
It also asks people to be participatory in their own treatment, in mm-hmm. their own life. So if you have SSI.
Social Security.
Yeah. You know, and you're getting, say, $800 a month from that.
But it's just not enough. Yeah.
Instead of just getting free housing and using that money for drugs, or what, we're saying you need to participate in this. You need to have some skin in the game. So we're going to ask you to give 30% of your income.
Yeah, so it would be a supplemental thing.
Yeah, but if your income is $100 a month, then your rent would be $30 a month. So it's not about really getting more money for the program. It's about getting people to have an investment in their own life.
And there may be some people who are simply down on their luck. They've lost a job, so maybe training them in a new career field or helping them get an education.
Well, that might be the case. That's probably not the kind of person that would go into supportive housing. I think the supportive housing kind of comes from the concept that most of these people on the street are very injured.
They're
chronically homeless for a reason, and that probably is schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, severe alcohol and substance abuse that may have resulted and now damage to their brain, and they're never going to be able to go out and rent a house and have a full-time job and do these things. And I think accepting that makes sense. So here's what's really interesting.
But we don't give up on them as people.
No. You never give up on people.
Are compassionate. Mm-hmm.
So here's what's interesting. This is really a win-win situation because it gets mm-hmm. people off the street, but it also saves money. So in Houston, they did a study, and they saw that it costs almost $15,000 more per person per year to have somebody living on the street versus living in supportive housing.
Well, that certainly can be true. I know, for example, if somebody's on the street, very often they wind up with medical emergencies. You probably see that at the ER. They're in and out for treatment of things that happen to them on the street. Maybe they're getting pneumonia or whatever it is, getting hit by cars. It wouldn't happen if they were in some kind of housing.
Well, certainly that's part of it. But also, the ER is used as kind of a social clearinghouse. So people come into the ER and they say, I'm suicidal. Now, there's no test or blood work or x-ray we can do to see if somebody's really suicidal. So we have to admit them.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks that are homeless, many of them are on a cycle where they get their SSI money, they use it, they come into the psychiatric hospital, they stay for 2 or 3 days, they mm-hmm. get discharged, they go out on the street for a few days, then they go to the next psychiatric hospital and make the rounds, and they'll hit, there's about 12 in town.
Yeah.
So they hit all 12, and then the first of the month again, they get their check and it's back again. And it's a very expensive, the way I will say it, it's a $100,000 solution for a $100 problem.
Yeah, there you go. Sometimes it just makes sense to invest in them as a person instead of waiting until it's a crisis and you're spending a lot more. On another note, A few years ago, in response to having so many refugees from the Middle East and other places, you started a wonderful community garden program where the refugees could come in, grow vegetables, sell them at a farmer's market. And recently, I was surprised to hear the farmer's market had just closed. Can you tell us what happened? And do you think that, you know, with the Performing Arts Center and the hotel and everything coming into downtown, is there a hope that that might be revived?
Well, I know that the farmer's market did close. I don't know very much about what the specifics were about that.
Mm-hmm.
I was just told that economically it wasn't working, that there, the feeling was there weren't enough people living in the downtown area to really support a farmer's market. And the places where farmer's markets have been successful are where you have a lot of urban living.
Are there plans to bring more housing to downtown?
Yeah, I actually live right downtown. I live in a townhouse, and the development company that built my townhouse just built another 100 of those. So I think that's going to bring more people in. We just went to a groundbreaking yesterday for a new 70 apartment units, which are not the low-end apartments, but very high, nice, beautiful.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, what do you see as the right mix there? Is there a way to do it's great to have the higher end for those that can afford it?
Well, this is actually subsidized.
Okay.
So they're nice places, but they're also subsidized low-income housing.
Oh, okay.
And specifically, they're geared towards, this one is at least, geared towards veterans.
Well, very good.
Towards getting veterans placed in housing.
Yeah, that's so important. We didn't even mention that, but a significant portion of those homeless folks out there are veterans who served our country. And it seems like, you know, no veteran should wind up on the streets, whatever their other problems may be.
No, absolutely. In answer to your question, I think there is a good thing to talk about in this respect.
Mm-hmm.
El Cajon, what has an abundance is low-income housing. Because in the 50s and 60s, they allowed anybody to build any kind of apartment complex in El Cajon. We have a lot of really fairly low-end multi-unit housing.
Yeah, in the old days, I mean, there were a lot of places that were kind of dumpy. Now we're seeing housing built that looks very nice, and you wouldn't know necessarily that it's got a component for low income.
And that's by design. Our thought is that we are doing more than our share of carrying the water for low-income housing in San Diego County region. It's interesting to me. People often say, well, there's so much poverty in El Cajon. You know, what are you going to do about that? I say, well, there's really not much you can do about that. When you have low-income housing, you're going to have poverty. And frankly, we don't want to push low-income housing out because people need a place to live.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a thorny problem. I know nowadays to get even a one-bedroom apartment to rent is, what, $1,100, $1,200?
Yeah, I would have said 13.
$1,300, maybe more. I mean, I can remember right out of high school, my first apartment that I shared with two friends, my share of it for a three-bedroom apartment was $100 a month. I was able, you know, to have a half-time job at minimum wage, put myself through community college. You know, my folks bought books, but I paid all the tuition, and still afford an apartment. And, you know, the kids today, they can't do it. The minimum wage has not quite doubled, but housing costs have gone up many fold. So it's a real difficult issue.
No, and, I blame regulation on a lot of that. I mean, there's so many environmental regulations that before you even start building a house, it's almost $125,000. That's before you buy any land, just to satisfy all the regulations.
Yeah. So, Bill, I'm going to let you have the last word here, but are there any other things you're looking at that you would like to achieve or bring to El Cajon in the next year or two here?
Well, probably my passion right now, we talked about the supportive housing.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that is probably the compromise solution. There's no easy way to do this because I think I can raise the money to build that kind of place and to even support it on an ongoing basis. But the problem is that creates a vacuum. You open up 100 units. It doesn't just mean that the 100 people that live in El Cajon will go to those units. It could be that part of the several thousand people that are homeless in San Diego just take a quick trolley right over here and say, oh, all of our problems are solved.
Can you have a requirement that they have to have been an El Cajon resident for some period of time?
Or? Those are all questions that I'm looking at.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the answer, though. I think the answer, and this is kind of makes it really difficult. I think the answer is a collaborated effort between our region and all the other regions of San Diego.
So maybe they help to pay for some of this and then their residents could go there too?
I think we simultaneously build 7 or 10 of these facilities all throughout the county and get everybody to buy in, especially the county, because the county is sitting on a huge pile of money.
They are. I've often wondered, why is it that the county of San Diego, as large as they are, and they've got, you know, a couple billion dollars in reserves or more, why is it we don't have a homeless shelter in, say, you know, Spring Valley or Lakeside? They have homeless people, too. Why is it all fall, you know, to El Cajon to handle the problem?
Well, frankly, it's going to be up to the citizens to require that of the county officials.
Well, it's a very ambitious idea of bringing supportive housing to not only El Cajon, but many of the other communities in the unincorporated areas or even some of the other incorporated cities. So that's something exciting, I think, to watch for.
It's early in the exploratory phase right now. I'm planning on going to Houston next month to see what they've done there. They've been very successful with that. Mm-hmm. Salt Lake City has also been very successful in that.
Yes. Didn't the city of San Diego bring in a guy from Salt Lake City to head up their homeless help efforts?
Yes. And he's got some great credentials, and we'll see what happens with that. He and I probably differ a little bit. He's more of a housing first kind of guy, where he says, look, just open the housing and let people do all
whatever
the drugs and alcohol they want. And I think that I'm mostly against that because I can't fathom how that is compassionate. Helping people and just allowing them to die in their addictions. You can't convince me. Having been in the medical field for 30 years, you can't convince me that there's anything positive about being addicted to drugs or alcohol. It is horrific to your health. It's horrific to your relationships and to your family.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a very, I think, taking a long-term and compassionate view of it, Bill, in many ways. I'm going to give you the last word here. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about what's happening in El Cajon?
No, I think that El Cajon is really on the move. You know, we're building almost 500 houses this year. We're, like I said, there's new car dealerships, new hotels.
You just finished the animal shelter. We forgot to mention that.
Yeah, the new animal shelter is coming. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the nicest in the region. And, of course, one of the most exciting things is that we're going to reopen the East County Performing Arts Center, which we've talked about. And I think you can be proud of what's happening in El Cajon and where we're going. There's certainly no doubt that there are problems. We're a fairly big community compared to a lot of cities in the country. It seems like a small city compared to the size of other cities in our region, but it's a big city and it's got big city problems. And, you know, we're always going to have challenges, but I feel like we're moving in the right direction. And I certainly would love to get as much input as I can from other people that live in the city. So if you have thoughts, you can contact my office or you can call and set up an appointment to have coffee with me. I think if we all work together, it's all for the better.
Very good. Well, I really want to thank you for coming on the show today. And listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Bill Wells, the mayor of El Cajon. We want to wish you a happy holiday, Bill, you and your family. And thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you.
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.